It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, Wisconsin's roads are in bad shape and the road budget is up in the air. WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson joins us to discuss his five-part series on transportation issues and the lack of funding to fix them. First, as the Trump administration reviews new plans to counter ISIS in the Middle East, there are ongoing concerns over the potential for attacks inspired by the group here in the United States. At the same time, there's concern about terror attacks motivated by extremist groups on the far right after an attack on a Canadian mosque and a foiled attack plan allegedly targeting a synagogue in Florida. According to some reports, the Trump administration is planning to target counter-extremism efforts to prevent attacks inspired by ISIS and similar groups while dialing down efforts against far-right extremism. Our next guest says both should be a priority and it could be dangerous to ignore either of them. Brian Levin joins us now. He's a professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at the University of California, San Bernardino. Brian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, can we focus on both as a strategy, Brian? You know, ISIS-inspired violence and similar groups on the one hand, and far-right or white nationalist extremism on the other. Is there room in both for counter-extremist strategy?
Well, not only is there room for both, when I testified before Congress a little over a year ago, this is exactly what I said we should do. And it's more true now. We have the most multifaceted threat matrix that we've had in recent American history. And you can't just concentrate on one part of the ice when the shot on goal might come from another.
So the most multifaceted, I mean, I've only listed really two, ISIS and similar groups, Islamist extremist violence on the one hand, right-wing violence on the other. Is there more than that, or is that plenty?
Oh, no. We've got a diverse mix. We have nationalists of all kinds. We have single-issue folks, for instance, anti-abortion, violent anti-abortion, not people of goodwill, like my friends in the Catholic Church or something like that. We have an emergent, though not yet fully coalesced, hard left. So, and one of the things I think is important is, look, obviously, each movement, each extremist movement has its own set of leaders, its own goals, its own methods and tactics. But what we see during times of inflection, where we're at now, we see the ground shifting under the feet of many. What's important to understand is that affects a slew of extremist movements, and on top of that, the role that social networking plays in radicalizing and organizing folks of many different stripes. So absolutely, violent Salafist jihadists have their own ideological foundations, but a lot of the strategies and a lot of the conditions that affect radicalism in one instance very well can affect others. So what you do is you start off, for instance, like they do in medical school. This is the body. And then you go into the different types of maladies that might affect different organs and things like that. And that's where I think the mistake is being made. We have a threat that exists because we're at an inflection point, and then on top of that, we have social networking and this kind of reciprocal conflict and hatred where we could have a terrorist attack tomorrow and some other extremist will respond to it. So we really have to look at this holistically and not just cover one eye and say, we're going to ignore these others.
When I think of a lot of attacks or even foiled attacks lately, it isn't, you know, you picture the radical cell meeting up in a back room somewhere. Now it seems like the so-called lone wolf, the individual who's inspired by things they see maybe online, but they plan and organize their own attack. A, is that really the trend we're seeing? And B, if so, what do we do about that?
It is the trend we're seeing, although it depends on where you are. For instance, there is a tendency by some to say, look what's happening in Europe. Europe has a much different history and demographic and assimilation experience than we do, for instance. So right now, if you were to ask me across the ideological spectrum, if you had to, like, you know, hold me hostage and say who would represent the most frequent threat, it would be a loner or small cell that's not necessarily directed or coordinated. But that goes across the ideological spectrum, from sovereign citizens all the way to violent Salafist jihadists, all the way to an emergent but still nascent hard left, which is not yet at the point where some of these other extremists are, but it's something that we're keeping our eye on. And particularly with regard to loners, as more people see a change going on and feel powerless to do things, they have a repository on the internet that identifies tactics and targets and timing, so you don't have to join a group in the way that you did 20 or 30 years ago.
Right. So as a counter-extremist strategy, how the heck do you stop that? Because 99% of people who post, I made that number up, but most people who post an angry thing on the internet of whatever ideology are probably never going to commit an act of violence. How do you hone in on those very few who will?
That is a great question. And some of the research out there indicates that in a certain proportion of these plots, I've even heard the term, the number 40%, there's something called leakage. So for instance, give you an example. A lot of this can be over-inclusive, but in virtually every attack involving violent Salafist jihadists, even folks who pledge allegiance to ISIS, like what happened in San Bernardino, we noticed that they had Inspire magazine. So that might be a tip-off. If people start collecting weapons, or if people that are known in their community to their family suddenly become more aloof, and they're talking about violence or have some connection to weaponry in a way that does not appear usual, that's something that we should look at across the ideological spectrum. So when I go and train law enforcement, I talk about broad trends, and that includes everything, for instance, from firearms and bombs and things like that, to the use of social media, which many of these extremists share. And so what I'm saying is, you might have an extremist with ideology A who might look at websites from a completely different ideology because they might promote or train on tactics. So what we're seeing is a great cross-pollination with regard to strategies, even if the ideologies are different.
We're talking to Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at the University of California, San Bernardino. Brian, we've heard some reports, and this is not 100% locked in, but that the Trump administration really wants to shift most counter-extremism efforts to target various forms of Islamist extremism, less so on homegrown far-right, or you're saying now it sounds like far-left potential terrorist attacks. What do you think about that?
Let me just say, because I don't want to be the lead story on Hannity tonight. The hard left is at a different point than these other extremist movements. However, the fact that there is such wide discontent on the left, as time continues, what we are worried about is more people will say the normal political processes aren't working, and then they, we'll see an emergence of something similar, perhaps to the SLA, which kidnapped Patty Hearst, or the Weather Underground, which bombed the Capitol. In any event, trying to directly answer your question, it is thoroughly appropriate to look at violent Salafist jihadist terrorism. Indeed, there's going to be a change going on with respect to that as ISIS comes under increasing pressure territorially and with regard to their leadership. But nevertheless, they will continue to have a repository on the internet and in social media to promote not only their ideologies, but also to radicalize and even train by proxy. However, we have such a diverse risk now that the idea that we would be devoting a disproportionate amount of resources to just one threat, for whatever reason, maybe it's politics, I'm not here to cast aspersion on people, but we really have to look at the broad range of threats. And if you look at some of the data out there, it indicates that the threat from the hard right has been nearly as significant. Some researchers will say you more in the post 9/11 era. Our center still maintains that the biggest threat comes from the most prominent threat comes from violent Salafist jihadists. But tomorrow we could wake up to, God forbid, another Sikh temple shooting, or a Quebec, or something else, or something against a Jewish institution. There's such a diversity with regard to not only ideologies, but also unstable people who will attach and pick and choose pieces of ideologies, that we can't just focus on any one area, because we'll leave a lot of the shots on goal not covered.
And Brian, as we wrap up, and we in the media obviously pay a lot of attention to terrorism, you and your line of work more so, but from the perspective of the public, is the overall risk of being affected directly by a terrorist attack all that high?
No, until it is. Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying is, I testified before Congress at the end of October. By early December, our community was hit. But bottom line is, we have a big risk from the disbursement of heavy weaponry and handguns throughout the United States. But you're much more likely of being killed in a vehicular accident where we have 30,000 deaths or more per year than in a terrorist attack. However, here's the thing that we're seeing. We're seeing an increasing desire for terrorists to use weapons of mass destruction, and we're seeing the body counts increase over time. So that's something that is of concern to us. So in some ways, looking in the rearview mirror doesn't tell us what the wild card will be tomorrow.
We'll leave it there. Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Brian Levin, professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at the University of California, San Bernardino. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up this weekend, members of the Democratic National Committee met in Atlanta and elected former Labor Secretary Tom Perez as their new chair. We'll talk about the election and the future of the Democratic Party with a political scientist. Right now, Wisconsin has arrived at a turning point when it comes to how we pay for roads, and this debate comes at a time when road conditions in some parts of the state are deteriorating. Some of these challenges are out of the state's hands, others may have been self-inflicted. Wisconsin Public Radio is airing a five-part series on transportation funding this week that explores how we got here and what happens next. We begin with a look back at the 2005 repeal of a gas tax indexing law that used to help pay for Wisconsin's roads. As Sean Johnson reports, indexing was a bipartisan idea that had a bipartisan unraveling.
Former Wisconsin Governor Tony Earle hasn't held office since 1987, but when he visits the state capitol square in Madison, he still gets recognized. Earle is sitting down for an interview at one of the local pubs when Madison Representative Diane Hesselbein, a fellow Democrat, stops by to say hi.
Yes, nice to see you, Diane.
Nice to see you again.
Not surprising, we're talking about politics.
You are. I'm just shocked about that.
Earle jokes that he's talking about the good old days when everything was better. But when it comes to the way politics used to work, Tony Earle isn't kidding around. He says Republicans and Democrats used to talk all the time and work together on big issues like road funding.
I wish there were more of that. You recognize someone for their abilities. You don't stop when you see a D or an R after the name.
Earle even hired a Republican, Lowell Jackson, to be his secretary of the Department of Transportation. He got to know Jackson when they were both running for governor. Earle says they were both considered underdogs, so they debated each other during primary season. Jackson joked about it during this debate in August of 1982.
And Tony Earle, you and I have debated so often that I just don't know what to say about you, except I think I've taught you too much.
That included automatic gas tax indexing. Earle calls Jackson the founder of gas tax indexing in Wisconsin and says his idea was relatively simple. The cost of gasoline goes up and down. The need for road projects is constant. Legislators don't like to vote for gas tax increases, so indexing tied them to inflation, and they went up automatically.
Most people never noticed, so there was never a bellyache, where if you don't have it indexed when you need it, you got to go and ask the legislature for a tax increase, and nobody likes to do that. Nobody likes to vote for it. Indexing removes that.
Indexing was in effect for the last 2 years of Earl's administration, but it was Wisconsin's next governor who really saw the benefits.
When I was governor, there was the joke that in Wisconsin there are two seasons, winter time and highway construction time, because we were rebuilding highways all over the state.
Republican Tommy Thompson served 14 years as Wisconsin's governor. He signed two gas tax increases into law, but the gas tax went up automatically through indexing 11 times. Thompson says indexing helped Wisconsin build its highways and grow the economy. Thompson understands some critics viewed indexing as taxation without representation.
In theory, that's very good. But the truth of the matter is nobody's going to vote for a gasoline tax, and as a result of that, our highways are in bad shape. It was a trade-off.
By 2005, Wisconsin was more polarized than in the days of Thompson or Earl. The legislature's Republican leaders still favored indexing, but many rank-and-file GOP lawmakers wanted it repealed. Those rank-and-file members had a powerful ally in conservative talk radio in Milwaukee. And when then-Assembly Speaker John Gard took to Mark Belling's show to warn of the dangers of repealing indexing, Belling repeatedly shouted him down.
Mark, I believe you'd long-term devastate a lot of very badly needed infrastructure improvements around the state. I'm sorry?
Let's test it then.
Both Gard and Senate Republican Majority Leader Dale Schultz changed their minds and voted to repeal indexing. That left the issue in the hands of Democratic Governor Jim Doyle, who was facing re-election in 2006.
I will be signing the bill that will repeal the automatic tax increase.
Doyle signed the repeal without fanfare, but at the time he said he still wanted the state to fund all of its transportation projects.
I think the legislature is now putting itself on the hot spot, and that's probably where they deserve to be, that if they want to have those projects and if it's the result is that they have to increase the gas tax, then they're going to have to do it in a straightforward way and take that vote.
3 years later, with his reelection behind him and the legislature now under Democratic control, Doyle said it was time for the state to bring back gas tax indexing. But that never happened. Indexing would have increased Wisconsin's gas tax by 6 cents per gallon by now, but its repeal cost state government roughly $1.2 billion. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
WPR's Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson is in the studio with us now for more on that and his transportation series. Sean, good to have you back.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, this is and was the hot budget issue last budget season, this budget season. How are we going to pay for roads? We're going to have to put off projects, things like that. You're tackling this issue in a five-part series, and it sounds like this gas tax indexing repeal is part of our origin story of how we got to where we are today.
I think so. I mean, when you just think about the situation we're in, why we're in the situation we're in. You need money to build roads, and then you have to decide how much you want to build. And essentially what the state of Wisconsin did with that vote in 2005 was decide that it was going to have less money to bring in, but the appetite for building roads continued. It kept building. And so that's kind of where we are today, where you've reached a turning point, I think it's fair to say.
And that gas tax index was indexed to inflation. Costs go up, the gas tax goes up with it. And we've heard in recent DOT audits, they're underestimating the costs of road building in part because they're not taking into account inflation, which, again, the gas tax is not keeping up with. So in absolute dollars, we, in a way, have less money coming out of the gas tax.
Yeah, and the whole idea behind this gas tax, you sort of see why it was put in now that it's been taken away. I mean, there was this idea when it was put in, as you heard former governors articulate there, that people don't like to take that vote, that it's an unpopular vote to go out and raise the gas tax. So we just recognize, we the government recognize that highways are something that only the government can do. We're going to go in with this gas tax. We're going to index this so that it goes up automatically. And then, we've essentially got that part of the equation taken care of. When indexing was repealed in 2006, there was a lot of talk by lawmakers and the governor that, hey, we got to make some decisions now. We either have to cut projects or we have to go out and we have to find new revenue. And they haven't done either.
Neither of those has happened. And so now there's a lot of talk. Are we going to borrow? Are we going to raise revenue? Or are we going to ration, in effect, our road building and road maintenance. Is anybody now talking about, hey, maybe we should bring back this gas tax indexing?
You hear some people talking about it, mostly Democratic lawmakers. You think of Peter Barca, the Assembly Democratic Minority Leader, has said pretty clearly, forcefully, that he wants to do it. Democrats who served on the legislature's budget committee last session said they want to do it. The Senate Minority Leader, Jen Schilling, has said she's open to it. As far as Republicans who actually have to make these calls because they're running the legislature and then they're in the governor's office, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss voted to repeal indexing in 2005. Now, this session, he said, I want to keep all options on the table. I haven't heard him address indexing specifically. Senator Fitzgerald, again, voted to end indexing in 2005. Haven't heard him address it specifically. And then Governor Walker's had a pretty hardline stand against any taxes in this budget.
This is part one of a five-part series. Just give us a quick preview. What are we coming up with next?
Yeah, so tomorrow there's going to be a story about kind of that continued building that we've had. We've continued to build these big projects even though we don't have as much money coming in. Wednesday there'll be a story about the effect of weight on roads, and you know, really nothing damages roads like heavy trucks, heavy vehicles, and Wisconsin has continued to embrace those heavy vehicles. Thursday, it'll be a story about kind of how we've gotten, or where we are now. You know, the situation of local roads, the conditions of local roads is pretty bad in some places. And then Friday, it's a look ahead to what happens next.
We'll leave it there. Sean, thanks as always.
Thanks, Rob.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. We'll bring you part two of this series at this time tomorrow and check back in with Sean later on with more on the series. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a political scientist about this weekend's election of a new Democratic National Committee chair and whether divisions within the Democratic Party are widening, are closable, what it means for future elections. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we get the inside scoop on the little orchestra that could Pink Martini. First this weekend, the Democratic National Committee met in Atlanta to elect new leadership. Former Labor Secretary Tom Perez beat U.S. Representative Keith Ellison from Minnesota in the election for DNC chair. The win was relatively narrow. The race was close enough to require a second round of balloting. This was the first contested race for DNC leadership since 1985. Perez will now help navigate thousands of state and local elections where the party hopes to reverse the many losses of the last 7 years. I want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think the Democratic Party needs to change? What do you see as the future of the party? How do you think Democrats will or won't come back from losses in 2010 and 2016? Call in now and share your thoughts and on that new leadership at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Jaime Regalado joins us now to talk about the election and the future of the Democratic Party. He's a professor emeritus of political science at California State University, Los Angeles. Jaime, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let's start with the headline here. What do you make of the news that Tom Perez is the new DNC chair?
Well, in a sense, it's a replay of the divisions that we saw in the Democratic primary, but also carried through the general election for president, but not nearly as severe. Both Ellison and Perez have been progressive Democrats. Ellison with much more experience on the ground in the local communities and organizing. Perez, it was state government with federal government for a number of years during the Obama administration. He headed the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. He was kind of point man on voting rights and on targeting aggression against minorities on the part of state and local governments. So he's been around. He's a progressive. He wasn't the favorite candidate of the progressive of DNC, but nevertheless he won. And now that he has appointed Ellison to be his chief deputy, it looks like some of the discord has been smoothed over.
Right, a lot of the media attention here, and you know, some of what we've heard from Democratic activists on this, made this out as a mainstream, more centrist against a progressive Bernie Sanders insurgent sort of contest. Was that a fair characterization?
Not entirely fair. They're looking at who is backing whom. And, of course, if you want to look at the institutional candidate who is being backed by the Clintons but also by Obama, then that's Tom Perez. There's no question about that. But what they're not looking is at what Tom has been over the years, both in the Justice Department, at the state level before that, and as head of the Department of Labor. He has a very, very close relationship with labor, still a weakened pillar, but a pillar nonetheless. Of the Democratic Party and of the left.
I got to say, I mean, no contested effort for the DNC chief since they were saying 1985. Even when there's a Republican contest, like when Reince Priebus from Wisconsin became the RNC chair, there was a competition. I can't remember that much attention being paid to it. It seems like there's more focus on this one. Am I right? And if so, why?
You're right. Because of the devastating loss that Democrats suffered last year and the rise of Trump. But it's not simply that. I mean, that's a lot to chew on. But also, there's been a neglect of the state and local Democratic Party machinery to the extent that the Republicans have been very, very smart and not just aiming for national prizes, but also for state and local prizes as well. So I think a lot of things came to a boiling head this year in the run for the DNC chair, because there are so many more disgruntled Democrats, and the party is horribly divided. It has been horribly divided between its left and its center. So now is the time to look at all of those things, and hence you get a contested primary, a contested race for the chair of the Democratic National Committee.
I want to lay out the case here in Wisconsin. Some people argued as long as 10, 12 years ago that the Democratic Party in Wisconsin was sort of more of a fictional construct. A lot of the work was done by teachers' unions, other unions, public employee unions in particular. And now, after changes here in Wisconsin, those public employee unions and the private unions, because of right to work, less powerful, less money to throw into campaigns, the Democrats really have nothing to work with. Is that something you see happening in other states around the country, the Democrats not really having their own viable organization?
It's tough. There's no question labor has been on the wane for some time, but not in and of itself. In other words, it's not entirely labor's fault. It has been a focus of the right wing, of Republicans who have been anxious to weaken institutions within the Democratic Party, and none stood taller or more powerful than labor over the years. So they did a really good job in whittling away at the power of the private sector unions. But the public sector unions have grown over the years, have become very politically powerful, and the mainstay of the political campaigning of the Democratic Party. And so they became a target with a lot of different kind of measures that have had 50-state strategies on the part of conservatives, Grover Norquist and others, and called paycheck protection actions that would threaten to weaken public sector unions by asking their members to have written consent, or the unions have written consent of the members each and every year for spending any dollar of their dollars on political purposes. It's one of the ways of saying that public sector unions are also and especially in the target sides of those who don't like the Democratic Party and don't like this lasting institutional pillar. What it means for Democrats is that they also have to look elsewhere. They're still going to have unions to play with in California. Public sector unions are still very, very strong as they are elsewhere, but they're weakening. So they need allies elsewhere, and institutional allies, as well as the bodies, the individuals and communities that make up perhaps the new majority over the coming 5 to 10 years.
Jaime Regalado is with us from California State University, Los Angeles, looking at the change in leadership in the Democratic National Committee, a vote this weekend. Tom Perez, a former labor secretary, won that post. Not everybody in the Democratic Party happy with that. Jaime, so one of the concerns from, you know, if we can call it the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party, just to oversimplify vastly there, but the idea that the Clintons, Bill and Hillary, too comfortable with Wall Street as a source of funding, spending too much time with national fundraising, taking the party away from grassroots organizing, building up state organizations, local level fundraising. Is that a fair critique of the Democratic Party?
It's a legitimate concern. And Tom Perez is going to have his work cut out for him. But the fact that he has Ralph Ellison, the Invisible Man, is not there.
Keith Ellison.
It's Keith Ellison. The fact that he has Keith on board as well, and it's going to be interesting to see what latitude he kind of gives Keith to be a player as well within the DNC. But it's the pressure is really on Tom in terms of a careful balancing act of keeping some of those funders in line, given what we said about the lack of institutional powers outside of labor within the Democratic Party. They can use Bernie's approach much more frequently than they have in the past to go after individual donors at all levels, and impartially offset that. But it's a fair criticism because that's been where the Democratic Party has been in the past. But this era that we're entering, this Trump era beyond, is like no recent era that we've seen. And the Democrats are fighting to survive. So he's going to have to make good on his pledges to restart the engine, the Democratic Party engine, at the local and state levels to make sure that they're strong, they're going to be competitive, especially for the midterm elections in 2018, win some of those governorships back, win some of the legislators back, so that they have a better than even chance, or at least an even chance, when the next round of redistricting comes around as well. That's going to be pivotal. So, it's a fair criticism. Let's see what Perez does. The first, second, and third priorities he's going to have. He's going to have to roll out. And so let's say the proof will be in the pudding. But he's going to have to live with part of that criticism as well, though.
President Obama, when he won the general elections two times in a row, he had this Organizing for America group. People gave it a lot of props for high tech, you know, really using social media and phones and apps and things like that to organize voters and getting a lot of organizers out in the field. And we've been seeing reports of Democratic Party activists at the state level around the country saying, yeah, so what? It didn't help us much at all in the following elections. We've lost both houses of Congress, as you mentioned, governorship, state legislatures. Was there a failure to communicate there between Organizing for America and the Democratic Party?
It was huge. It was huge. They had tunnel vision, focusing on the presidential campaigns, focusing on Washington, but starting with the president and leaving alone to kind of slide under the radar to the dire benefit or the lack of benefit to the Democratic Party, the state structures, the local party structures that have withered. Withered by what? Withered by comparison with Republican strategists understanding they needed to work and to win at state and local levels, but especially the state levels. So it was a poor strategy by the Democrats, and one that they're living with right now. They're not in control of redistricting. They're not in they're in control of only about a third of the state houses in the country. They control, the chances are they're going to control even less before they start to turn the ship around. So it was tunnel vision, focused on the presidency and not focused on where it really counts, building the legs, building the mortar in the states that would give rise to a strong Democratic Party.
Jaime Regalado is with us from California State University, Los Angeles, looking at the election this weekend for new Democratic National Committee leadership. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see from new Democratic Party leadership? How would you like to see the party change? Do you think Democrats can come together and unify after the divisions over Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders in the 2016 presidential primary? Love to hear from you, whether you're looking at this from the inside out as a Democrat or from the outside in as an independent or Republican. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about this weekend's Democratic National Committee three-day meeting and the election of new leadership. Jamie Regalado is with us, political science professor emeritus from California State University, Los Angeles. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your prescription for the Democratic Party after some years of losing in a lot of elections, apart from the presidential level for a couple elections there, but not in 2016? What do you think the party would need to do to rebuild? What would you like to see happen on the local, state, and national levels? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Here's a listen to new DNC Chair Tom Perez giving his acceptance speech.
We need to make house calls. We need to listen to people. We need to get back to basics, and we need to move forward, because I am confident, my friends, I am confident that when we lead with our values and lead with our actions, we succeed. That is what the Democratic Party has always been about, and that is what we will continue to be about. When we communicate our message of inclusion and opportunity for everyone, the big tent that we are, that is our strength, my friends. And when we have these conversations, sometimes spirited, sometimes difficult, that's not a sign of weakness. That's a sign of strength as a party. And that's what we will continue to do.
To quote, what was the Will Rogers quote? I don't belong to an organized political party. I'm a Democrat. Is Tom Perez embracing that attitude?
He kind of is. Let's be frank about the role of the party chair, though, what that person is really is supposed to do in terms of his main roles. One is to raise funds. How is he going to go about that, especially with the criticism that the Democratic Party has been too close to Wall Street financiers, et cetera? Is he going to push more of a Bernie type of movement to focus on the smaller donors, but many more of them? So that remains to be seen, but fundraising is one of the chief roles of that office. Recruiting candidates to run is going to be another one, and then representing the party in the media is a third. Recruiting candidates speaks of the grassroots, and that's where the Democrats have been very, very weak in during Obama's years in the White House. The focus has been so steadily on the national level that they let go of building a bench and or raising a bench and raising candidate profiles and candidates whose butts will warm those benches to run for office at local level, city councils, school boards, even community college boards, but also to the state legislature. And that is probably most important, to have a bench and to have candidates who can be competitive. But that hasn't really been grown. And so that's going to have to be a brand new thing, a brand new venture, where a lot of the attention of this new administration of Perez, as well as Ellison, is going to have to be moving.
Let's bring on a caller now. James is with us in Mauston. James, hi.
Hi. To go along with the bench analogy, how do you see the DNC growing that bench up to be more inclusive? And then also a second question, how do you see the DNC focusing towards more of the general broader millennial generation?
James, thanks for the call. I mean, inclusiveness in general and toward millennials in particular.
Yeah, well, I mean, that speaks to a local and state strategy of getting to know the local players, the local leaders in the Democratic Party who can help you identify those who they think are going to emerge in a variety of communities to make it much more diverse and inclusive. And the locals know best. They just haven't been paid much attention to over the past 7 to 8 years. So I think it's one of the ways to do it. There is talent out there. They are Democrats. They're left-leaning independents that can be swayed to run for the Democratic Party if they feel there's a future in that party and it's open to their candidacies. So I think all this is very important, and what it means is the administration, the top levels of the administration of the DNC now, are going to have to, with their staffs, spend a whole lot of time on the road.
and talk to those local leaders, meet those emerging candidates, visit various communities, communities of color, working class communities, middle class communities, and so on. And that's going to amount to a lot of time they're going to have to spend. And from what Perez is sounding like and what Ellison has sounded like continuously is that they're going to be able to do that. So we'll wait and see. I forget the second part of the question.
Millennials in particular?
Yeah, and that's crucial. That vote is crucial. Most of the Democratic vote in the primary among millennials went to Bernie. Many of those, some of those stayed home for the general election, but more voted for the third and fourth party candidates. Very, very few went over to Trump, so the danger was not going over to Trump. The prescription is to try to get them back and understand the Democratic Party's under new leadership now. It understands the importance not only of millennials, but of progressive of all walks and shades in different communities around the country. And they need him to run to engage in this battle, a battle unlike we've seen in the United States for years and years and years.
Thanks for the call, James. We're talking to Jaime Regalado from California State University, Los Angeles, about a possible new direction for the Democratic Party. We go next to Dave in the UP of Michigan. Dave, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I'm a registered Democrat that voted for Trump and plan on switching parties, and I know other people have already done the same thing. There were a lot of Democrats that voted for Trump because I don't believe the Democrat Party represents anything I believe anymore. The issues they seem to be focused on are just bizarre to a lot of us. And, I don't think the party is run by everyday Democrats anymore and what they represent.
And, Dave, briefly, what issues do you think they've left you behind on?
Well, I think most people, the reason Trump won, because a lot of working class people like me want to see jobs come back to America that have left this country. I didn't hear anything about that in the last couple of years. A lot of people in Pennsylvania, Michigan, I'm from Michigan, mm-hmm. and Wisconsin that are working class Democrats voted for Trump because of that.
I gotcha, Dave. Thanks a lot. And Jaime, that was a big part of the story in Wisconsin. I've seen the numbers. A lot of traditional Republicans voted for Trump. A lot of traditional Democrats voted for Clinton. And then there were a lot of counties that switched from Obama wins to Trump wins, I think partly based on voters like Dave. What do you think about the Democratic Party's thinking on that?
Well, it's a real issue that is only now being talked seriously about, and that is the messaging wasn't there. And if it was there, the few times it was there during the primary and general election campaign, there was not much emphasis put behind it. That means the economy and jobs. What are you going to do about those left behind, those who the global economy is harming? What are we going to do about them? And so at least the new leadership is talking about that. It remains to be seen how they roll that out, what they roll out. But they're going to have to underscore that lesson. I know a lot of Democrats did vote for Trump. A lot of union members, and this is the consternation of labor right now, how to get their union members back, voted for Trump. And so it became a big issue, a huge issue, and for the reasons that this caller just now mentioned. And that is that where were the Democrats talking about those issues, talking about the pain of the working class in the Midwestern states? It was a huge falling and a failing, I should say, and I think the new leadership understands that. Now, how I go about changing that is going to be a little bit difficult, but they're going to have to try hard.
Bring on one more caller, Teddy in Kewaskum. Teddy, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
Yes. I think the Democrats are not aggressive enough, to really promote their agenda. If you look at what the Republicans are selling right now, they are really selling nothing mm-hmm. besides repealing and taking the country back,
Teddy, we're just about out of time, but briefly, Jaime, the Clinton campaign was critiqued, and Democrats in general, too much anti-Trump, not enough pro-something in the election.
Not enough pro-policy. You have tigers in control of the Democratic National Committee now. I've never heard that before. Tigers in the leadership. Tigers for what? For change. For progressive change. For talking about issues that resonate among the working class, which is supposed to be a bedrock constituency of the Democratic Party. They need to regain part of that back, but they need to have a selling moment, something that workers understand.
Thanks a lot for the call, Teddy and Dave. Jaime, thanks a lot for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That was Jaime Regalado. He's a professor emeritus of political science at California State University, Los Angeles. He was with us to talk about this weekend's meeting of the Democratic National Committee at Atlanta and the election of new leadership and whether or not that can help heal some of the divides in the Democratic Party. Still time for you to share your thoughts, by the way. You can head over and join the discussion on the Central Time Facebook page, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Or again, the Central Time Facebook page. Share your thoughts. Read a little extra there. A new study is giving us some more reasons to eat our fruits and vegetables. Most guidelines say aim for 5 servings of fruits and veggies per day, which according to surveys, a lot of us are having trouble doing as it is. But a new study published in the International Journal of Epidemiology says 10 servings does a lot more to reduce the risk of heart disease, stroke, cancer, and other causes of death. Producer Amanda Magnus eats a lot of veggies here in the station. She joins us now for inspiration. Hey.
Hey, Rob, I am bowled over by this news. I've been working so hard to get my 5, and frankly, it's a struggle many days.
Well, here, I was reading up. A serving is smaller than you think. Like a baseball-sized, a hardball-sized apple, that's a serving. A bigger apple could be 2 cup of greens. That's a serving if you pack them. You eat a lot of veggies in front of us.
Yes, I eat a lot of veggies. It's typically my afternoon snack when I'm directing the show, like today. I have
like
some
a bag
spinach.
Of spinach.
Yep, I eat a lot of spinach. I also have carrots pretty much every day.
A highlight of the pitch meeting is you. A big knife and a red bell pepper.
I eat a whole pepper every day. Yep, lots of vitamin C, especially this time of year.
I bet if you measured it out, you're probably hitting pretty close to 10.
I hope so.
At least from what I'm with. I mean, maybe you're at home and it's Twinkies for breakfast and dinner. I don't know.
Every day. I only eat my veggies here, Rob.
Oh, okay. Really?
No, I eat a lot of vegetables.
All right. So a quick inspiring word for people?
Just do it. It's not as hard as you think.
All right. 10 servings of veggies if you can. At least get up to 5. This is Central Time.